Services and Women's Wellness. This is an informational hearing. We do not have this bill yet in our committee. It's on the Senate side. But because we have several members on our committee who are also on that committee, we're asking them to make a presentation today about this bill. And normally I do not take testimony during an informational hearing, but there is one person who will not be able to return on the day that we do have an open meeting about this bill and work session. So I will allow one person to testify for that. That's all I will be allowing. So Representative Cowan, who I'm calling on at a very inopportune moment.
Would you like to... now ready. I thought you were going to take some testimony. I'm sorry.
Would like to tell us about this bill, and we would ask other members of that subcommittee if you would tell us about your impressions of this bill also.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and welcome to those of you who actually managed to come for an 8 a.m. meeting. Bless your heart. So, oops. The chair speaks ill to you when that happens.
Please turn off your cell phones, as reminds us, and please turn them completely off, not just on mute, because when they're on, it does something to the sound system. And so all of this is tape recorded while we're here today, and then it goes into these wonderful archives, which is just fascinating. But if we have cell phones on, somehow that disturbs the whatever the recording does. So we ask you to turn them completely off, include your BlackBerries also, not just on mute. Thank
Madam
you.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I believe that the representative on the far left was not aware that he could go back at nighttime and re-listen to himself on the tapes.
Oh! And you could probably even see yourself on the video.
She's the one on the far left.
My right. We have a little debate about the organization of the seating arrangement on this committee occasionally, as you have now been treated to that. Our proceedings here are also broadcast on TV and computers and things that I don't understand. So we try to be as informative as possible and make sure that people are sort of part of the inside jokes that you see in this room and things like that. Don't think that we're completely crazy when they're listening to us without benefit of being in the room. It's my privilege today to sort of review for this committee before we see it. We don't usually get to review bills before we see them, and to share with our listening audience and our audience here some of what went into the development of what is now Senate Bill 1061, which, as a matter of fact, is probably going to be approved before we finish talking today on the Senate side. It is the first bill up on the Senate side at 8:30 this morning, and then it will be coming to this committee in the near future. The impetus behind Senate Bill 1061 was really at the end of the last session. Many of us sat down and kind of took inventory and said, you know, we didn't make the progress that we would have liked to do, like to have made in the arena of services to seniors and people with disabilities. And there were many reasons for that, mostly that there was a backlog of many, many things that we needed to do, and for the first time in 07, we saw a little bit more favorable revenue picture so that we were able to do many things in that session. The other thing was that a variety of folks brought issues to us in different bills, and it was difficult to sort of make that all coalesce into what's the most important to do first. So that was the driving factor behind several of us as we brought together all of the folks that we could find who were primary advocates of the senior and people with disability communities, many of whom are sitting in the room right now, and brought people around a big table and said, okay, how are we going to come up with something more comprehensive and collaborative that we can truly move forward? And we did the inevitable brainstorming, and we made up this giant laundry list of everything that we'd like to do in a perfect world. And one of the things that I had said going in was, I'm not interested in developing another task force to study the issue. We have all the task forces and recommendations that we need. We need to figure out how to take the next step. Well, the bill that I'm about to explain is primarily a planning document now, and I'm going to tell you how that came to be, but I do think it's a step up from another task force, if you will. The bill itself has a number of whereas kinds of language in it. That won't come out in actual statute when we're done, but they are important because they refer to the fact that Oregon has been a pioneer in developing community-based care and a variety of options for seniors and people with disability. Consequently, we have the lowest rate in 50 states of institutionalization in terms of nursing home placement, that there are many other options before folks. But what we're seeing now is that our system is beginning to crumble, and it's being driven by a number of things. This bill primarily focuses on seniors and people with physical disabilities. And we are seeing that aging demographic grow dramatically. We've seen it for some time. All of you have been watching that upward curve. We've known it was coming, and it's now time that we really need to step back and put our heads together and do that comprehensive planning to figure out how to deal with a larger population of folks needing some sort of assistance. And it's my personal experience and my strong belief that while community-based care, doing what we can to keep people healthy and independent and comfortable in their own homes for as long as possible, that is a primary goal. But we also have to recognize that it is not a failure if someone is not able to stay forever in their initial personal home. Sometimes people need varying degrees of assistance as the aging process takes its toll, one of those things I'm beginning to be personally aware of on a much more direct level than I once was. Growing old is not for sissies, is what I've decided. But as I work through the end-of-life processes with a number of elder members of my family, I was the primary caregiver for six of my elderly family members, and begin to see the array of needs that they had, and it really emphasized to me the importance of what I like to call that mid-level kind of care facility, the residential care, assisted living, or adult foster care, something that's much more personal and independent than a nursing home setting, particularly one where an individual might be one of four or six in a ward kind of bed situation. And when we looked at that, we also saw that there's a real growing disparity between the rate of reimbursement to those facilities for individuals who are Medicaid eligible and what they receive from private pay residents. And that's a distinct and unique part of this particular residential structure. In the developmentally disabled world, where we have group homes and that kind of thing for reasons over which they have no control, essentially all, I think is fair to say, Representative Gelser, are Medicaid eligible. So we have a little different challenge. We have a big challenge in that world, but we have a little different challenge than this one of trying to balance appropriate percentages of income, of revenue streams for the facilities who are trying to meet the needs of both the Medicaid population and the private pay clients. And recent trends have showed us that our system that we're so proud of is changing. And we've seen an increase for the first time in nursing home placements, and we're seeing a decrease in the access for Medicaid clients to the mid-level facilities. It really hit home for me when, during the session, actually, in 2007, one of the assisted living facilities in my district decided for a variety of reasons, including financial, that they would no longer accept Medicaid clients, and they did it on an immediate basis, a 60-day withdrawal, and they essentially threw out 15 people who were residing in that facility. It was hugely traumatic for the individuals impacted, for their families, their friends, and their caseworkers. We had a day where the caseworkers had to sit through 15 separate family meetings where they were telling those individuals that they would no longer be able to reside in the facility that they thought was their permanent home. And that there's a head nodding in the audience because there's an individual in the audience who had to be part of that whole process, and Scott Bond knows exactly how traumatic it was for his workers. I don't think that should ever happen again. There are a variety of reasons. The particular corporate ownership of that facility is still in place, and at the moment they are not, with deference to some of the other folks in the audience, I want to make it very clear that they are not members of the Oregon Healthcare Association, and they have not changed their practices, and that facility, I think, is about to close. It has a current census of 4, and for some reason it's struggling in my community. So let's move on to everybody else and the really strong players in this arena who want to be part of a solution. And consequently, what bubbled up in our conversations was the first thing, the crisis that's hitting us right now is that we need to raise the rates, the Medicaid rates that the state pays to the assisted living, adult foster care, residential care facilities. And you will not see that directly addressed in Senate Bill 1061, and that's because the department took a proactive approach to this as well and built that rate increase into its rebalance proposal, which is sort of separate from the ongoing conversations we have about in this arena. That rebalance conversation is still going on in Ways and Means, and we're working through it. And in fairness, I want to also say that the industry who provides these residential care facilities has just really stepped up to the plate. They have been there in in-depth conversations over the last few weeks about what we could and what we can't do, and they have changed some of the business decisions. I have a letter on file from the chief operating officer of SunWest, which is one of the major corporations providing assisted living facilities, saying that they had applied to do the gradual withdrawal, to begin to move out of that market, and they have changed that plan of action and withdrawn that request because they've seen the attention that we are paying to the rate increase, and they want to be part of providing a holistic community where they can address the needs of all the folks who need residential placement. Particularly, they're a corporation who provides a lot of the rural communities, and they understand that in our rural communities, we don't want to differentiate. We want everybody to be together, and we don't want to talk about what the source of the payment is. So those conversations are going along really very well. I'm very pleased with the attention that this conversation has brought to that issue. And I believe that we are going to find some solutions in the near term to stop the loss of access and to, in fact, increase access in the market.
Representative Cowan, I'm just going to stop you from that because I neglected to mention that we have two other members on that subcommittee who are here, Representative Gelson and Representative Ron Maurer. And I would hope that you also will be contributing to this presentation. And I believe it's at 1 o'clock that you have a joint meeting with the Senate committee.
That is correct.
True? And at that point, you will be invited to give public testimony. I'm assuming that's true, isn't
yes.
it? You will be,
yes. Kind of on a broad basis into the area that I'm going to get into next.
Right. That's great. And so there was one gentleman, as I mentioned, who will not be here at 1 o'clock today. Is that correct? Right. And so he will be testifying here, but it will not be open testimony to anyone else. So
thank you.
Thank you.
I am I'm counting on the other members of my subcommittee, Representative Gelser and Maurer, to help me out when I get bogged down here or to tell me what I've missed when I'm done with this tirade. To the bill itself, I'd like to take the opportunity to talk a little bit more about what we've been able to do up to this point as to what's actually in it. The Department of Human Services had a what's called in this building a budget note, a directive to look at some comprehensive collaborative planning around the needs of the long-term care system. And this bill sort of codifies that. It beefs up that direction, if you will, to say, yes, we have got to be looking at that report very soon. And the department is currently working on that effort and will be coming back to us with their review of the system in sometime in midway through the year in this year, in 2008. And that will allow us then to have the information that we need to build into the 09 session and beyond. And I do not look at this as being something that we will do in one fell swoop, that we need to build through over the next period of years. But the second time then, the second thing that we did when we looked at this bill is that we defined many of those things that had kind of bubbled up in the brainstorming session, and we asked the department also be much more specific than they might be in a normal comprehensive planning effort, in that they give us some cost figures. If these are the things that we believe that need to be done, and what will they cost? And that way we have the adequate information to build that into future bills per se. We talk about improving access and to the system for seniors and people with physical disabilities, and following any of the procedural things that we need to do around Medicaid waivers and creating that reimbursement structure that will assure that we will continue to have access for all. And then in the second section, we kind of tried to build in the laundry list of all of the things that we want to do, but without being specific. As much as possible, we took out the specific program name or acronym because we're thinking a little more holistically than we'll make sure we take care of this program or that program. The first thing on that list, and these are not necessarily in prioritized order, they're just there, but they do happen to be Section 2, Item 1, which is line 19 on page 2 of the bill, if anyone's following along. And that is stabilization and provision of adequate funding for Oregon Project Independence. OPI, as it's come to be known, has also come to be synonymous with what we do for seniors in Oregon. And it's a fine program that assists with in-home care and other support needs to help people forestall the day that they might need to move into other kind of residential care or might be able to stay in their own homes for their lifetime. It's a program that struggled with adequate funding over the years, and there's a strong belief that it needs to be stabilized so that we can continue to provide those services. It isn't the only thing we do for seniors and people with physical disabilities in Oregon, however, and so we also want to look at some other things. We brought back a conversation about the general assistance funding that Representative Kotak kind of spearheaded in the last session, because there's a gap for folks that with just a little more help they could do better. And one of the things that fell off was the medically needy program in terms of prescription reimbursements. And it makes no sense if an individual is unable to stay on a monthly, weekly, daily prescription for a chronic condition, and then without that medication, they move into a health crisis, and it costs far more money down the road to take care of that. So we really need to re-look at our thinking. And what drives my thought process in all of this is, what's the most cost-effective things to do? What can we do up front that will cost less money, be more humane, be the right thing for people, and avoid those huge costs that we have at the other end of the system, which are inevitable? And because my thought process is going there, I would remind folks that if we don't have good placement options within those mid-level care facilities that I talked about, then Medicaid-eligible clients who need outside-the-home placement will go directly into nursing homes. The state will pay for that at a much higher rate, and that's the reason the mid-level is so important. We also talked a great deal about strengthening the volunteer programs that we have out there working in all of our communities, which need to be commended. Oregon simply wouldn't run without its volunteer programs. And we specifically highlighted the Senior Companion Program and the Retired Senior Volunteer Program just as sort of examples of programs that may have some reimbursement for folks in them, but they're highly dependent on kind of a volunteer base as well. But my thoughts are that this is a, while we have this demographic that shows us with an aging population, it also means that many of us sitting in this room, and myself included, are moving into that senior population quickly. It's very close. And what we're going to have is a retired population of individuals who have been active in their careers and are not ready to stop doing everything that they've been doing. And I don't know what the volunteer programs of the future may look like. I think we should leave that box open and let people tell us what they'd like to be doing and what we could contribute. We also talked about looking into developing a long-term care system that's not funded by Medicaid, and what we mean by that are early intervention programs, things that we can talk to people about, do for people in the early stages before they're forced to spend down that nest egg that most of us count on taking us through our senior years and hopefully never become Medicaid eligible, because we've been able to meet our needs less expensively and that savings has lasted longer. There are a variety of folks experimenting with single points of entry. No one front door. What, I can't remember what Senator Morissette calls his program.
The new front door.
I'm sorry?
The new front door?
New front door. I think that's a healthcare directed system. But there are a variety of programs that folks are experimenting with out there that we need to look at more comprehensively. We also recognized that there are workforce challenges. We don't have as many people going into the workforce in this whole arena. And for those that are there, we need to better support them and provide more training and keep folks happy and well-equipped to provide the services that are necessary. We know that the needs of people with physical disabilities whose need for assistance starts at a younger age, they're different than the elderly population. And we need to recognize that in our system and perhaps provide our services a little bit differently. We also need to more fully explore the unique challenges within mental health services and addiction treatment for seniors. Several of those challenges are significantly different than a younger population. We talk about confusion with prescription drugs and inadvertent challenges, and the depression that sadly often follows the aging process that can lead folks into other addictive behaviors such as alcohol. I mentioned the need for training. We'd like to explore the facility licensure question and the moratorium that currently exists on new facilities, and see how we can better relate our opportunities to put in more facilities and to build in some percentage of care of the Medicaid population and broaden the access. And then just sort of look at a whole range of other alternative long-term care models that are out there and being experimented with, better support for family and volunteer caregivers. This is an area where it's easy to burn out after you've been at it for a little while if you don't have a good support system. and also to explore a bit the expanding population of folks with traumatic brain injuries and other kinds of challenges that lead them into long-term care needs. And particularly, we've highlighted that with our returning soldier population and the challenges of this war, we're seeing more traumatic brain injury. And that's a population that's going to grow. So my mouth is getting dry and I'm running out of steam, and I'd really like to allow the other representatives to jump in here at what I've missed.
Thank you so much, Representative Cowan. Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First, I really wanted to commend Representative Cowan for her leadership on this issue, which actually did not begin in the interim, but began early during last session, as she spoke to us often, frequently, and for a long time about about very important things. And I just really honor Representative Cowan for speaking up about complicated issues that are important to so many people and an increasing number of people as this baby boomer tsunami comes upon us. And I think that what we have before us here in Senate Bill 1061A is a result of that work and Representative Cowan's leadership in bringing many, many people together to talk about how we can get to the next place and put together a comprehensive planning process that brings everyone together and looks not just at a band-aid of what can we do right now, but how do we get someplace in the future. I think that for the rest of us, both legislators in this room and outside this room and the community, we have a responsibility to back up this plan by having very loud voices around the need to invest in our human service program. It's very frustrating to me to see this kind of work, to see the effort that the advocates and the agency and the workers and the organizations and leaders like Representative Cowan and Senator Morissette put into making these things happen when we don't know where the money is going to come from to back up those efforts. Just this week over in the Ways and Means Committee, the recommendation to pull $30 million of general fund out of seniors and people with disabilities in the face of these problems and this crisis tells me that as a legislature, we don't yet get the importance of the services that are provided by that agency. That agency has been coming to the legislature for a very long time to talk to us about the problems that they face and the many programs that they administer. We haven't always responded in the way that we should responsibly with the resources that they need, and instead when they come back to us, we, myself included, push back and say, why aren't you taking care of these problems? Why do you have these issues? And yet we haven't been willing to provide the resources that are necessary. Some of us come in and we want to make changes, and I'm certainly in this category that say, let's fix this problem now and please come back with a fiscal that's as small as possible. So we'll take an agency that's small and troubled and has many problems, we pull money out, and then we ask them to do more things and tell them to pretend like it doesn't cost any money. And I am just as responsible for that as any others. But we all have to work together to help this entire body recognize that these services and these needs are not going away. We cannot afford to continue our disinvestment in these services. And we have to recognize the organizational vulnerability of the only agency whose budget is revisited substantially during the interim. No other agency has to come back and account for a caseload that's off by a little bit and have that projected out over the entire biennium and then lose that amount of money. And it just seems funny to me that our most vulnerable folks, the needs that we know are the most pressing, that tend not to be partisan needs, are the ones that we say, if you're a little off, we're going to take all the money out, and we may or may not come back later. I know that we're moving forward into a recession, and possibly into a recession. I don't want to say we are moving forward into a recession. There's signs that we're in a pre-recession, and we know that that increased costs in other areas. But we have to remember that our most vulnerable populations, seniors, people with physical disabilities, people with developmental disabilities, mental health, these are fairly stable populations that always need our support, whether our economy is up or our economy is down. And we know that they're in trouble when, even when times are good, we're sucking money out of these programs. So, of course, when times are bad, like they are right now, we end up with proposals like sucking $30 million in general funds out of seniors and people with disabilities. So I really support this proposal that's come forward. I think it represents some excellent thinking. But in order for us to be able to implement it, we really need to stand together. We need to support the agency in giving them the budget that they need to do the things that we demand and ask of them, and that the vulnerable populations that they serve are. We need to recognize that we're, you know, kind of on the same team here in serving this population, and we need to help our colleagues in ways and means understand why this is so critical. So to the advocates, I thank you. To the department, particularly seniors and people with disabilities, I want you to know that I recognize the burdens that you work under, and you have my commitment to do everything that I can to help get you the resources that you need to do these things and the many other things that need to be done to address the needs of the people I know all of you are very committed to serving. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Gelson. Representative?
Thanks, Madam Chair.
Mauer.
Thanks, Representative Cowan. She's done all the heavy lifting in this process, and it did come clear early in the session when you had the assisted living crisis.
Yeah.
And that kind of, I'd say, awoke a sleeping giant, so to speak. And so you should be credited for that work. I'm going to take a slightly different tack than Representative Gelser and say that I think Oregon needs to celebrate its successes and acknowledges the things that we do well. First off, you know, and Representative Cowan said it, you know, Oregon leads the country in long-term care. And so we don't want to lose that status. And because if we don't, we're just going to get swamped. The money is just not going to be there. So I think we need to celebrate that and use that as a inertial mass to keep going. I want to celebrate our volunteers in Oregon. I live in Grants Pass and I'm on a foundation board for the hospital and work a little bit with the volunteers in that hospital. And I had an opportunity to work in Fairbanks, Alaska for a year and see a facility called Fairbanks Memorial Hospital. We're very isolated. But in some of the meetings, I was working, you know, with the Army. I was activating the Army. And in some of the meetings we had with the hospital talked about volunteers. And at that hospital in Fairbanks, Alaska, they have just a handful of volunteers up there. And I was absolutely shocked because my expectation at Three Rivers Community Hospital, we have hundreds of volunteers. And our hospital, our local community hospital, would not survive without the volunteers. And although there are some young volunteers in the program, the vast majority are seniors, people that are retired and that want to contribute to the community and do. And they have found their niche at the hospital. But it's not a handful, it's hundreds. And so I think Oregon needs to celebrate that, the volunteerism that we have. I think a program that was, and I don't know as much as I need to at this point, but there was a bill that passed about long-term care insurance, and it changed some of the rules for long-term care insurance last session. And in a conversation that I had with a broker out of Medford, she said she was frankly stunned with the response to that program, that in fact it does seem to be working, and that because long-term care insurance traditionally has just been too expensive for people to purchase. And so by changing some of the rules, we expand the population that it makes sense for. It is not the solution, but it does, you know, it was testified to in committee that if we got 12% of the population in a long-term care insurance program, that we'd be doing really good. And currently we're at like 6. But this may open that window to expand it So that takes, maybe just relieves a little pressure off of some of our programs in the future. Now to the bad news.
Before you move on.
Yes, ma'am.
Perhaps maybe we won't have time this session, but perhaps next session we could have an informational hearing about long-term insurance, because that's the impression I think many people have had. It's too expensive. So perhaps we could do that during the 09 session.
Absolutely. I think it would be very important, especially if we're doing something right and we want to spread the word, so
right,
to speak.
Right. Thank you.
And now the flip side of the coin, and Representative Cowan did an excellent job of summarizing all of the problems, but I think we talk about the demographics, which drives a lot of it, but the reality is, at the federal level, the Medicaid dollars are changing. We are not going to get more Medicaid dollars. The Medicaid program across the country is shrinking as a part of the Deficit Reduction Act, and it continues to shrink and will continue to shrink. I don't see that changing. And so I think that this process, it has a real challenge in front of it. And I would suggest that the most interesting conversation may be around how the state, or at what point do you say Medicaid dollars aren't worth it? The strings attached to federal programs, to federal dollars, sometimes override the value of those dollars. And that, because OPI, there is no match, which gives us great flexibility in how we implement that program. And the question may be, in in-home care dollars, you get a Medicaid match, but at some point, and that's a discussion to be had, that where does Medicaid match not make sense for the state of Oregon? You know, let's assume that those Medicaid dollars are going to get smaller anyway, and if you're having to create a bureaucracy, if you're having to create hurdles where seniors are unable to receive resources because of bureaucratic hurdles that the feds have put up, then maybe it makes sense to just say, no, we don't want that part of your money, because we will be able to deliver more services, better services to the people in the state. That will be a very interesting conversation. And I believe the McKinsey group, the consulting group, is going to tackle that issue, I think. And I hope they do, because it's complex. And besides the political ramification, but the reality is, if we can make a better government, then we should make a better government. Something that really isn't addressed in here that I hope is addressed is that any time you talk about seniors, at some point you need to talk about end-of-life issues. And that you know, end-of-life issues are not solely medical. They're not health care. That this is the convergence between life and health care, and that we need to address that on both sides of the discussion. Clearly, in the healthcare field, we discuss it, but I think it's something that is absolutely vital to the discussion of seniors and people with disabilities, are end-of-life issues, because unless we can get a handle on that, and Oregon, you know, again, Oregon is not the problem nationally. It's other states are far and away behind us. Not even, Oregon is so far out in front. I would say the only state that on end-of-life issues maybe is Arizona, is in front of us. But I think that has to be part of it. I'm not quite sure where it fits, but it is important. It is important. Because you shouldn't start talking about it the week and the month before it happens. It needs to be you need to know where you are spiritually, you know, where you are in relationship to that endpoint. And one thing, I guess I'm a little out of order, is when we talk about volunteers for the seniors, I think another major issue is workforce. Not workforce for the facilities, but how do we get the seniors to continue to be engaged in the workforce in a manner that is is both beneficial for the employer and the employee. And that means that maybe we need to look at rules and how tax policy interplays with using part-time employees. You know, we have vast amounts of experience with seniors. And with our general workforce shrinking, we're going to have to find new ways of tackling that workforce problem. And I know in Grants Pass, in Jewish-Green County, we have many seniors that would love to work part-time. You know, they're not looking for the six-figure salary. They want to occupy their time in a fruitful manner. And in my clinic, and it's kind of happened by accident, but in our clinic, I now have one critical piece of my staff is over 65. And then we just retired another staff person who was 62. We have another one that is now 55, and we have one young girl who's 18. But these people are absolutely vital. Without them, without their experience in our clinic, we would not be able to operate. And so, you know, I hope that we can talk about workforce because it is a major issue in this state. And anyway, this is great. This is a great bill. It's a great bill. It's a great conversation. And Sarah's points are all, you know, right on target. This is not a bipartisan issue, but it is a resource.
It is a bipartisan.
It is a bipartisan.
I'm sorry.
It's not a partisan issue.
Thank you for pushing.
And we love.
I can put that on
we
the
can make it.
In this building?
In this committee? No.
There's no partisanship in this building.
No.
In this
committee. But the resource issue does become, that's where the politics come in. And we hate pitting one really great interest versus another one, but we do that every day. And that, unfortunately, is why we get paid the little bucks. Little bucks to help make those decisions. So I'll stop rambling. Thank you.
Madam Chair, could I just do a brief ramble?
Of course.
Thank you. I want to take a moment to thank the chair of this committee for affording us the opportunity to sort of splinter off into a subcommittee focused solely and primarily on this range of issues, because we don't have the time in this particular structure to really delve into all of the ramifications of everything that comes before us, and that's why a lot of the work is done outside of committee. But I think that what you just heard today from the fellow members of this group really highlights the amount of expertise we have sitting up here and the value of bringing that level of experience and expertise into what is a very broad region, broad and complex situation. I don't even know how to describe it because it's really kind of too big to get your brain around sometimes. But I'm just thankful that we have the opportunity to explore this because I think it is a very, very important issue for the state of Oregon. And we're absolutely right. Oregon has been doing progressive thinking for a long time. When I have a out-of-state kind of commitment, I usually try to add an extra day so I can sort of look at the aging system in those areas. And when you go in and say, so tell me about what you're doing, what they get is, well, no, but you're from Oregon. What are you doing? You know, so it's a little hard to gather information because people look to us, and I think that's important. So, and then I just wanted to remind folks that the 1 o'clock hearing this afternoon will, as the chair said, be a joint hearing with the members of this subcommittee and the Senate Committee on Seniors and People with Disability, chaired by Senator Morissette. Sorry, he probably wouldn't appreciate being called representative. And it is going to be an opportunity for people to offer input on the challenges that they see and the things that we should be doing as we move this conversation down the road into the next session. So thank you for the opportunity to have this conversation.
Oh, thank you for all the work you've done. Representative Gelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I meant to mention this in my comments, and it came up in both of your wrap-up comments. It is true, and we can be very proud of being on the leading edge of community-based services in the nation, but I think that also presents a danger to us if we become too comfortable with the idea that we are leading, because the problem that we face right now is that our entire system is crumbling. And sometimes it's hard to get the attention of folks to give that the attention that it needs, because we can all wave the flag of saying that we are the leaders. I like Representative Cowan, have had the chance to go to a couple of conferences and present on issues primarily in the DD system. And, you know, people come and say, oh, you're from Oregon. Everything is perfect there. And people are very surprised to learn about the challenges that we face. And we do have some things to learn from some other communities. And, again, one of the reasons I appreciate this bill, appreciate the work that Representative Cowan is doing and all of the stakeholders in the room, is really focusing in on what do we need to do to make sure that we don't crumble, so that we don't go from leading the pack to falling way behind, because we are in significant danger of having that happen here in Oregon.
Any questions of our panel? I want to commend you. This was an incredible presentation, and it made me feel so proud that each of you brought a very different perspective to this, and that you each have been very thoughtful about what you've done in this subcommittee and how you've presented it to this group and to us. And, you know, I often say how proud I am of this committee, that I've got the best committee in this building, and you just are more evidence of that. So I'm going to applaud you. Thank you so much.
You haven't happened very often.
No, you've done a fantastic job. You know, Representative Gelster has 4 young children. Representative Maurer lives in Grants Pass, which is, 5 hours away.
And he has children.
And you have children, right? And a wife, 4 children. And you have a wife in medical school. Representative Cowan lives in Newport, which is, again, 3 hours away, and has children and grandchildren. So
she has dogs that miss her.
They put in extra time, as they've done with this subcommittee. It says a lot about their commitment to this building and commitment to these issues. So, again, I commend you and thank you for doing this.
Thank you.
Now, any other questions? Okay, we have a gentleman who wishes, and we're only going to allow one person, as I said, to testify today, because this is an informational hearing. The rest of you will have a chance at 1 o'clock today to let your interests be known.
Good morning, Madam Chair, other distinguished members of the committee. My name is George Hayen.
Could you spell your last name, please?
H-A-Y-E-N.
H-A-Y-E-N.
My wife and I have been foster care providers now for 2 years. When we first started considering getting to be foster care providers, it was about 6 years ago. It took me about 3 years to pay off my property and then refinance and build a beautiful care facility. We added 3,700 square feet to our home. It has got every safety measure, 30-something handrails, guardrails, everything. There's enough room for 2 wheelchairs down my hallway. We did it absolutely right. We had dreams of hitting the private pay market, making money. You know, obviously everything is, we live in an economic-driven state. You know, we want to make a living. We want to pay our bills, get our health insurance, get some money for retirement. Once the place was built, we were shocked that this private pay money really doesn't exist for people like us. It's pretty much capitalized by those that are in the healthcare industry already, nurses, people that have retired working from hospitals, have got a lot of connections in the hospitals, and all that private pay money goes to those people. So at first we wasn't going to do a Medicaid contract, but we found out that we couldn't fill the room. We had this big expensive place that was sitting empty. So we decided to open up a Medicaid contract, and we filled up real soon. During this time, we found so many problems with being able to make ends meet. and the care needs of those people that really needed care. We really did want to support the community, provide care for seniors, and at the same time have a home-based business that, you know, we could get out of the rat race a little bit. Since that time, we've went up to a level 2 home. Just to clarify what the levels of care are for foster care homes. A class 1 is just needing assistance in up to 4 of the ADLs, they call them, the activities of daily living, which include eating and feeding yourself, bathing and personal hygiene, toileting, dressing and grooming oneself, your mobility and transferring and getting around. The rules are set up to where somebody has to be able to evacuate a home in 3 minutes or less to comply with state rules. And another one is the cognition and behavior management. So now we're up to a class 2 license, which means that we can have people with dependencies. And that's where the shortfall starts coming in. Last year, me and my wife, we had an elderly gentleman. His name was Martin. He was 88 years old, an outstanding gentleman, always had a smile, never had a complaint. Been a proud man, served in a world war. We knew that he had terminal cancer. He came in into level 1 care. He was able to get around, do things by himself. It was a real joy. And when his health started to slide down, we decided we wanted to keep him in our home. So we asked the state for an exemption to carry a higher level of a license. And eventually we did take him to end of life. During this time, he became fully bedbound. He soiled himself 5-6 times a day. We did get a little bit of help from hospice. They came in for basically 3 hours a week. And if you know how many hours a day and how many hours there is in a week, there's a lot of care. We were forced to hire additional staff because we needed 2 people on hand, 24 hours a day for this, just one gentleman. And we had four other people to take care of. Just hiring somebody at minimum wage and being an employer and paying all the employee taxes and all the things that come with being an employer, we were barely able to make enough money off Medicaid just to pay this one additional staff, which meant this person was living in our home basically with no profit whatsoever for us. But still we did. We gave him dignity. We kept him clean. Every time his family showed up, he was dressed. His hair was combed. He was shaved. He had the dignity and respect he deserved. But now, once we went through that, and we get other calls from people, and they say, we got mom, you know, she's in a wheelchair, she can't get up in and out of it, she's obese, and I don't discriminate on things like that, but I also know that it's just me and my wife, and to move somebody in and out of a chair, to have to clean them in bed when they cannot get to the bathroom, is something that me and my wife just physically, even though I'm a big guy, my wife is a small person, and we're not able to do that, even with our classification of license, without additional staffing. So when somebody calls and I ask the questions before they even come see the house, about the last question I ask them is this Medicaid? And when they say yes, I turn them down. I just cannot. I cannot afford to take the emotional stress, the monetary stress, and the physical work that it takes to keep somebody in a home-like setting and keep them with the dignity that we've provided Martin to anyone else. Since then, I've started taking some mental health clients through Marion County Mental Health, which we are allowed to have a couple of people in our home of 5. And I'm kind of disappointed because now we've got a whole bunch of people that drank themselves or did drugs until they ended up in court and in jail so many times that they had them evaluated. Now they've got a mental designation. And I've got drunks in my house that are still, when they get their private money, are drinking and smoking dope, while we've got seniors that don't drink anymore, don't smoke dope anymore, don't have any of the same problems that these people have, and I get paid more money to deal with mental health people. And I don't have to ever wipe them. I don't have to feed them. I don't have to do any of these things other than make sure that they don't get so drunk that they ruin my house. I would love to be able to deal with just the senior population. I would love to take care of people's moms and dads and give them the dignity and the respect that they need. But at this point, the money just doesn't add up to be able to run my household. We are right at the brink of financial ruin with the money we spent on building a beautiful facility and the amount of money that we pay out in bills. In the last year, we've averaged 3.8 people in our home per month. So we have a residency level of 5. But we're not able to keep that fifth room full. We're just not able to. There's just not the right people out there that we can handle. With that 3.8 margin, we're paying out in bills. Even if the home was empty right now, we'd be paying out in bills for, you know, our mortgage, all our insurances. I have to carry liability insurance. I have to make sure, you know, the fire insurance. I have to pay my own personal health insurance now. So with that, almost $1,200 a month in food, $400 a month average for electricity. You add that all up, it comes out to about $4,700 a month. And carrying that 3.8 persons per month, I'm only taking in about $5,500 a month through Medicaid. It's not nearly as much as I used to make when I worked for, you know, construction for 25 years. My wife was fully employed, and we decided to get out of that to do foster care. Now we're making very little money. And to top it all off, I've been out to dinner with my wife one time in the last 4 months. I haven't had a weekend off for 2 years. I haven't had a vacation for 6 years. Certain things that we all take for granted, things that we enjoy to get out away from work and heal our souls and heal our bodies. It's to the point now to where me and my wife are getting very burnt out. And we're right at the brink of shutting it all down, selling it all, and getting out of the business. Now, it's not typical for most people to take that kind of hardship and be able to deal with it. There's a lot of providers that I talk to, and they're in the same boat as I am. When somebody goes up to level 2, they're refusing to have people in their homes. Level 2 and level 3 care, that's when we are at our most frail. We are unable to do anything when we get into those stages of life. And believe me, we will all be there. Unless we just die of a sudden heart attack one day and are hauled off on a gurney, we are going to get old, we are going to get frail, we are going to be in need, and we're also not going to have family members to do that for us. We are in an economic-driven society. There is no way that any of us in this room can quit our jobs right now to take care of mom or dad and maintain the economic needs to pay our bills to survive. That's why so many people are going into homes. We live in a great country, but we live on money. We are not able. I took this as an opportunity to be able to provide care for my own parents, have a home to where when my parents get to that frailty and they need that kind of care, that I would have a place for them, and I would give my mom and my dad everything that I would want to give to anybody, and to even your parents. But I am right close to financial ruin. And my mental and emotional state, I'm going through the burnout stage that we're all warned about during our classes with the Northwest Seniors and Disabilities. To take time for yourself. Make sure you are good. Take the time off to make sure you're fresh. The money does not allow me to do that. I would practically go into debt if I hired enough people to give me a little bit of time off. And without me and my wife being strong in character and strong emotionally to provide care to seniors, that's where we start getting into possible abuse issues or neglect that you see in some of the bigger institutions. And Martin, when he came to our house, came with a bed sore this big. He was festering. He was in an assisted living home. He was on private pay until he spent down, and he was left in his room and basically was rotting. When he came to our home, we worked diligently to make sure that we got rid of all the bed sores. It took months, literally months, to get this man healed up and to where he could feel good about himself. And his family was very pleased. We served the public need to the T. The family, we deal with the family emotions, to make sure that we can deal with what they're going through, because death of a parent is a tragic thing. It is absolutely tragic. And family members have a real hard time with seeing somebody that they love going downhill so quickly. And we're able to be that medium, to provide the comfort to the families, to provide the right needs to the seniors, and yet still try to maintain our own sanity, which is real close to the verge of saying I want out. Now, this is common amongst most of the new providers that come in that have maybe the fallacy that I had of being able to be the best in the state. I built my home for it to be the best in the state. I put a lot of effort. I've been a construction worker for 25 years, and I built this place from the ground up. I laid the foundation, and I put the last nail on the roof. I wanted it to be the best. Unfortunately, it will probably be sold to somebody else eventually, and they can have a nice home and have private pay people to work. They can hire the right staff to take care of people. Recently, I had an argument with somebody that was a private pay person that was totally in disagreement about the union and why they were forming. And even though I assured them that this really is just to do with Medicaid money and it has nothing to do with the private pay sector, they were still pretty belligerent. I asked them, I said, I'll tell you what, if I get another elderly person that goes up to that level 2, level 3 care, fully bedbound, would you be willing to take this person for $1,664 a month? Their answer was hell no. I mean, that's just the way it was. It's all about money for these private pay people. They absolutely will not take a Medicaid person, even at a level 1 care. They make an exception occasionally if they've had somebody that spent down after years of care and they knew that they didn't have much time left, and they give them the dignity to go into Medicaid and finish up their term there. But they won't accept any new people under the Medicaid system. And even now, I've been accused of discriminating. I get people calling and saying, I've got mom here, she's 260 pounds, she's fully wheelchair bound, and she's on Medicaid. And I said, I'm sorry, we're just not accepting any more Medicaid. Well, they're looking off the list, off the seniors list, and they said, well, you have a Medicaid license, why aren't you accepting this person? And I says, for one, I have a right to accept or not accept anybody in my home. And I says, I'm not gonna go into destitution to take care of mom, and I understand that you have need, but I just cannot do it. Well, then you need to get rid of your Medicaid license, I was told. And people are rude to me because they are so desperate to find a place for mom and dad, and they're having such a hard time to be able to find a place for their parents that it's frustrating for the families, and they even get to wit's end because very few people will accept it.
I'm sure your story can be repeated over and over again,
yes,
throughout,
ma'am,
the state. Yes.
So, that's basically my story, and it's a common story. It's something that you will hear. If you were to have 10 of us in here, you would hear the same story over and over again.
Yeah.
But the reality is that once these folks get to where they can't be taken care of in a home setting and get really good home-cooked meals and be provided with care that they need, it's just not going to be available for them anymore. Where's the funding going to come from? And then when they get put in a nursing home, we find out that they're getting paid almost 3 times more for the same care we were providing. That money is there somewhere. It's just appropriated in different venues, different avenues. When somebody says, okay, well, nobody is willing to take care of this person, they go into a nursing home to get the same exact care plus, because it's more people, there's more staff per person than you'll find in any facility. There's less reports of abuse or neglect that you will find in nursing care facilities, because it really is just a meat market. They're just like cattle being stamped through. They're allowed to fester. Well, we don't allow that. We take that pride to make sure that everyone is able to be healthy, even though they're a dying person, to be healthy, clean, let's say shaved, hair combed, things that when you have family come in and you see dad with his hair slicked all back and he's got a nice clean shirt, you go, dad, you look great.
Yeah.
We do those things.
We really.
They're not in pajamas all day and sitting there in front of the TV. The house smelled clean. I mean, we did everything it took to where when somebody walked in, it didn't smell like old people.
Representative Cowan, I know, has a question. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you for coming and taking the time out of what I know is a really challenging job that you have and sharing the information. Your story can be repeated many places. I think just a couple of things that I'd like to reassure you with, I guess, is that the quality of care issues are very important to this committee and to many of us that are looking into this issue at all levels of care in our residential care facilities. We appreciate the foster care providers. I know that you have fine facilities, and we also care a great deal about the quality care that's offered in assisted living facilities and in our nursing home facilities. We're hopeful that the relatively small monthly increase that we intend to be able to offer you by the end of this session or the beginning of the next fiscal year will be helpful in your situation, and I just sort of want to reassure you that we are continuing to look at it and to emphasize that the point that you were making about the cost of an individual being placed in a nursing home situation is exactly the issue that we're trying to highlight, that for a smaller number of dollars we can provide very high quality of care to people through the end of their lives. And if we don't do that, the state will be paying the cost of the nursing homes. Mm-hmm. And they're important parts of the continuum too. There are individuals who need to be in that more comprehensive care setting, but it gets to the end of life issues that Representative Maurer was talking about. We need options and appropriate levels for everyone's needs, and we're doing our best to address the situations that you so articulately brought up. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Cowan.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, do you have time for a few questions?
Yes.
Thank you. I appreciate that, Madam Chair, and thank you for your testimony, and I encourage you to keep doing the work you're doing, and we'll do what we can to make that easier for you. I have a couple questions. You mentioned having to purchase your own insurance. Would you mind sharing how much that's costing you, and what would that be if we could figure out some way to help you with that? Would that be a significant help in terms of your overall expenses? Do you have to also insure your wife as well?
Yes, and thank you for bringing that question up. Right now I'm working under COBRA. From my last employer, I was able to continue my insurance coverage at a slightly discounted rate, just medical only with no dental and no vision. We're paying $650 a month, which is a necessity. I just went through back surgery. I had back surgery just last week, lower laminectomy. And this all went from my job. A year ago, I quit doing drywall. And Mr. Martin, the gentleman I was talking about, it hurt me. Trying to get him in and out of the bathroom, and all of a sudden he would just want to collapse because the blood pressure is not where it's supposed to be, wherever he would just collapse, and I'd have to hold him and go down with him, and it hurt me. And I had no protection against myself other than my own private insurance, which I was fortunate to be able to, you know, keep continuing on. But on top of that, I have to make sure that I pay a liability insurance. Mm-hmm. Because in this society, people are so crazy. I mean, absolutely so crazy. Mom or dad falls down. We, in our own home, we could take a slip and a fall, and there's nobody there to sue. But you're in somebody else's home, all of a sudden, it's usually the family that attacks us and say, why'd you let mom fall? Why did
How
you
much
let that
is your
fall?
Liability insurance?
It's about $150 a month. Let's see here.
Did you have another question, Madison Kotek?
I do. Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, you mentioned about taking care of yourself, and you know that falls under the category in my head of available respite care. Can you speak to what we do in the state to provide some respite care for providers, not only yourself, but maybe, you know, a spouse or a loved one who's taking care of someone? I know that's not wouldn't solve the whole problem, but if there was an option out there to have someone come in, someone that you could either volunteer, someone that could be trusted to come in so you could take a break as opposed to an employee, I don't know how that would work, but I'm just wondering what would help or what we do now that is useful.
Well, certain little things would be helpful, like having a standardization of all respite care providers, in other words, substitute caregivers. The way it's set up right now, we have to basically hire our own people. They have to go through we have an orientation pamphlet that they have to read and fill out. But it's only good for my home. Mm-hmm. When they go through a criminal history check, it's only good through my home. There's no way to set up a bank of people like a little union hall to where you can call and say, I need respite care for tomorrow or the day after. I need them for certain hours. They have to go through the whole process in your home, which takes weeks. If you have a substitute caregiver that decides that you're just not giving them enough hours and they've got a better offer, which we've already had that happen twice, and they're doing in-home care, they only work 40 hours a week, this person that might need 24-hour-a-day care or at least somebody to stand by for 24 hours a day is getting it for 8 hours a day, and they make more money and get health insurance working with just one person than we're provided to work with five, let alone be able to take care of our employees. I couldn't pay my employee health insurance. I say when I had a full-time employee come in to help me with somebody that needed the extra care, just minimum wage and all my employee taxes that I had to pay, all my employer taxes that I had to pay and everything, equaled what I was getting for that gentleman total. To try to throw in health insurance for this person, and it was a good quality person that had done in-home care for 5-6 years. She was a friend of the family. I knew the family. Just a great person, knew all the medications. You could throw a generic medication name and she could tell you what the brand name was. I mean, she was that sharp. But I couldn't afford to keep her there, and she had to move on. Now we have a couple other people that maybe, hit and miss, can make it in for a few hours so we can go out to dinner. And those are the things that we've lost. If we weren't able to just standardize people and say, hey, it doesn't matter if you work with DD or Marion County Mental Health or Seniors with Disabilities, we're all going to go through the same criminal history check. It's going to be noted anywhere in the state that you've went through that Oregon State criminal history check, and it's good anywhere you want to go. You get a card or you get papers that say you are good, and you can go in anyone's home. It would make it easier to get the respite care and be able to call people in. Make sure that the training is all similar. I recently tried to go through a mental health license because I wanted to get a little bit easier care for the amount of dollars that came in. And even their rules are totally different. Rather than being under the same administrative rules, they have their own administrative rules, even though we get checks written by the same department. And they have to go through different trainings to get substitute caregiving. They've got to go through courses and training. And, I mean, I might sound bitter, but for a bunch of drunks. I mean, if you were to come in my home right after payday, you would see three drunk people in my home, even though I tell them there's no alcohol without a doctor's permission and a limit. There's no way you can stop them. They tell me that, you can't stop me. I want to do drugs, you can't stop me. And we've got these people in our systems while the old people are being pushed aside. That angers me.
Okay, one more question, Madam Chair. And thank you for that information. I guess the last question would be, your comment around hospice for the gentleman you were taking care of only 3 hours a week, mm-hmm. is that a function of the lack of resources at hospice? I'm just trying to get a sense of...
And that I wish I knew exactly what. But when we had hospice came in, because once a doctor diagnosed you with 6 months or less to the termination of your life, you qualify for hospice. And they send in a hospice nurse that comes in once a week. All she does is check for vitals, make sure there's no fluid on the lungs, takes a good look at, but if there's any bed sores or anything like that, and makes that note. She's basically the supervisor. Mm-hmm. And then we get a bath person, basically, that comes in. It's just a nurse's assistant. And she comes in twice a week for about an hour to help bathe. Twice a week. When you can't get up to use the bathroom, you're talking bathing five times a day. So it didn't offer us a whole lot of help. And when we asked for a little bit more assistance, they said, that's it. That's all you're going to get. They did provide, there was a lot of training and things that taught us how to deal with end of life. Sure. Because when somebody's not thirsty or they're not hungry, mm-hmm. it's human nature to try to get them to drink sure. and try to get them to eat. But we were assured by the nurses that we worked with, this is the way it is. Our bodies don't want fluids, and it doesn't want food anymore because it's running out of energy. Mm-hmm. So it's okay. And at first it seemed cold and callous to me. How could you possibly just say it's okay? It angered me. until I got more information, and they brought us pamphlets to read, and of the way it is. Mm-hmm. And I finally kind of lit up the light bulb and said, okay, I understand now. So now it's just about comfort and dignity. Mm-hmm. Giving these people, make sure they're kept clean. Like I say, when their kids come in, seeing that hair slick back, puts a smile on the family's face. That's what I got into this business for. But the emotional wear and tear it's taken on me and my wife, yeah, that's not what we got into it for.
Well, thanks for the additional, and thank you for being here. Thank you, Manager.
You bet. Any other questions? Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for the work that you do. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Dolly.
Thank you.
You bet. Colleagues, we're not having a meeting on Monday morning, and...
Oh, we don't have a meeting tomorrow either.
We won't have a meeting on Saturday nor Sunday.
Oh, wow. I'm coming on Sunday.
I know. We will be having, we will do a bill. We'll hear a bill on Tuesday, and we will have another informational hearing, and I'm not sure exactly what that will be.
That's a Coast Relay.
Is that the SPR,
yes.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
That we're getting?
Yes,
okay.
It's the Coast to Coast Relay. So, any other information for the good of the order? Again, thank you so much. You guys did a fantastic job. Anything else? All right. I close the Health Committee on Human Services.